Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Today's episode is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Where do we start? We have all of this, the news today, the House Judiciary Committee, more fallout from the firing of John Bolton. We have the president continuing to preemptively make concessions to the Iranians, but of course he fights. Supreme Court hands the Trump administration a big win on being able to prevent Central Americans from applying for asylum. We have all of this stuff to talk about, so who better than Benjamin Wittes, who is the editor-in-chief of Lawfare blog. Good to have you back, Benjamin.
Hey, good to be here.
Well, let's start off. I want to start off a little bit let's start off with impeachment, all things impeachment. House Judiciary Committee taking a vote to approve its procedures for impeachment. And everyone is confused about whether this actually means something, whether it doesn't mean anything. Jerry Nadler says he's tired of debating the nomenclature, whether or not we're talking about an inquiry or an investigation. So give me your take on where we are at, because From my point of view, the Democrats still do not look like they got their act together, have not really figured out what they want to do on impeachment.
Oh, I think they've figured out exactly what they want to do, which is to have an impeachment process when it's convenient to have it and not have an impeachment process when it's more convenient to deny that they're impeaching the president, and to leave the question of which they're actually doing to as late a date as it is possible. So they want to do as much as they can while retaining plausible deniability. And I actually think they've evolved into a sort of admirably unprincipled strategy. I say admirably kind of tongue in cheek. Unprincipled, you can see it as clever tactically, or you can see it as utterly lacking in moral content. I think both are probably correct. But what they've effectively done is they've created a process that they can argue to courts for litigation purposes is an impeachment process, that they can argue to the left flank of their own party, see, look, we're moving forward with an impeachment investigation, and that therefore kind of minimally satisfies the left's demands to do something about the president, and that also says to centrist voters who may not think that impeachment is the direction that the party should go, we're proceeding deliberatively, we have not made up our minds, we're not Newt Gingrich in 1998, we're not, full steam ahead to impeach the president, we're just doing our due diligence oversight. It may lead there or it may not. And so I think it is an attempt to be all things to all people, and, whether it is a clever such attempt or too clever by half, I think we'll have to see over the next 3 to 4 months.
So is this what Nancy Pelosi wants? Is this executing what her vision of impeachment is?
That's a really interesting question. So, I always joke that I never try to spend time in the head of Donald Trump. I actually have a lot of trouble spending time in the head of Nancy Pelosi because she's actually a hard target to figure out what she's thinking sometimes. I think the best way to understand this is that this is a compromise between Jerry Nadler and Nancy Pelosi, that Pelosi wants to go very slow on impeachment, and Nadler clearly wants to impeach the president. And so their compromise is don't have a formal vote and call it an impeachment inquiry. We're not going to put the centrist members of the caucus in that position. Do whatever you need to do, and you can call it an impeachment investigation, and I'll support you in all the litigation that you want to do using that nomenclature, and we'll decide later what the end game is. And so I think of it less as a reflection of Pelosi's strategy than as Pelosi's accommodation to Nadler and the more impeachment enthusiastic members of the Judiciary Committee.
I thought it was interesting that Jerry Nadler, after the vote this morning, made it clear that their inquiry would not be confined to the four corners of the Mueller probe, that they have other stuff, that they're going to go places that he did not go. Is that a positive development? I mean, that struck me as a sign of more aggressiveness than I've heard from them before.
So I think it's a very interesting development. And, you know, the irony is that the sort of major areas that this impeachment non-inquiry has expanded into are all matters that long predate the Mueller report. For example, emoluments and the sort of monetizing the presidency through the through Trump properties issue, as well as the Michael Cohen, Stormy Daniels, Karen McDougal set of issues, which are, you know, tangentially related to the Mueller investigation in the sense that Michael Cohen was a criminal target of the Mueller investigation and ultimately a cooperating witness. But it is an issue that has been sitting out there since long before the Mueller report came out. So the one interesting question is, if this stuff is worthy of contemplation for impeachment purposes, why now? Why not, you know, the first day of Trump's presidency? And I think the answer to that question is that, first of all, there's a perception in the Democratic caucus that the Mueller report wasn't enough. And, you know, but maybe the addition of the Mueller report obstruction material to existing anxieties and misconduct by the president might situate it in a different place. And then the second thing is that I do think that there's a complication with both the Karen McDougal, Stormy Daniels stuff and with the emoluments material that makes them a little bit awkward for impeachment purposes on their own. So with the Karen McDougal, Stormy Daniels stuff, this is activity that predates his presidency. And traditionally, we don't think of stuff that you did in before you became president as grounds for impeachment. So there could be complications there when you're talking about stuff that was corrupt in the context of getting elected president, right? In addition, I think for Democrats who have a memory of the Clinton impeachment, the idea of impeaching Trump for crimes associated with attempting to cover up illicit sexual behavior is awkward, since they've all argued, at least the ones old enough to have been in Congress at the time, all argued that those were not impeachable offenses. And so the idea that you would do that stuff as a standalone impeachment matter, I think made Democrats kind of nervous. Similarly with the emolument stuff, you know, that was stuff that people knew about Donald Trump when they voted for him. You know, people knew that he owned hotels and he promised he was going to, you know, keep running his business, right? So, you know, people kind of went into that one with their eyes open. And so I think when you put those things together, it's kind of understandable that Democrats looked at this and said, you know, I don't want to launch an impeachment investigation on this basis. That said, once you have one, you know, they're pretty grotesque behaviors by a president or by a would-be president. And so it makes a certain amount of sense to fold in consideration to an existing process once you've got one.
Well, that's what I'm wondering is whether or not there could be the, you know, rock rolling down the hill phenomenon here, that once they start this, they may be doing this this cynical, you know, two-step, but that the thing takes on a momentum of its own, and that at a certain point, the cumulative weight of all of these stories and all of these issues, you know, leads them to go further than they were. But I just want to step back, because you and I have talked about this many times over the last year, and it really strikes me that we're sitting here talking on September 12th, and this is where we are at. it feels, and tell me whether you agree or disagree, but it feels as if the whole summer was squandered, that window that was open with the Mueller report was the moment when, you know, if they were going to take action, that was when they needed to not necessarily begin impeachment proceedings, but really ramp up the public testimony, the hearings, the attempts to move public opinion on all of this. And none of that's happened. And it feels like the moment has passed for them, and that now we are just too late into it. We're into the election cycle. And so is that part of what's going on here, that they're going through the motions, but they recognize that moment has passed?
I could not agree with you more that the moment has passed. Whether that's the motivating factor, I don't know, or whether they're sort of trying to play catch up and recreate the moment. But the idea that the Mueller report came out and a blizzard of subpoenas did not follow the next day has never made any sense to me. You know, the idea that you're going to recapture the sense of outrage that people felt when they first read that strikes me as implausible. And I've never been sure why, look, given the administration's posture that they've, you know, made it very difficult for witnesses to come forward, they've, you know, resisted every subpoena issued to the maximum extent they can. You know, it may be the case that it would have been very hard to have hearings in real time. That said, you know, they didn't try. And their first witness, it was John Dean, which is, you know, 40 plus years after his relevance to presidential scandal was over. And, you know, Corey Lewandowski, who has no plausible basis not to show up and answer questions, they are only getting around to demanding his testimony now. And I think that is whether it's a tactical judgment or whether it's a just bad strategic management, I really don't know, but I do think it created a huge missed opportunity that we are going to be dealing with for a while.
Okay, I want to ask some potentially awkward questions about the Mueller report and where we're at here also. For some reason, it connects in my mind to some of the issues around the John Bolton firing, believe it or not. Stay with me, because I want to talk
about that. Yeah, I'm really curious.
This is a tease, and we'll do this right after hearing a word from our sponsor. Today's podcast is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Hiring can be a slow process. Cafe Altura's COO, Dylan Miskowitz, needed to hire a director of coffee for his organic coffee company, but he was having trouble finding qualified applicants. So he switched to ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its technology identifies people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job, so you get qualified candidates fast. Dylan posted his job on ZipRecruiter and said he was impressed by how quickly he had great candidates apply. He also used ZipRecruiter's candidate rating feature to filter his applicants so he could focus on the most relevant ones. And that's how Dylan found his new director of coffee in just a few days. With results like that, it's no wonder 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. See why ZipRecruiter is effective for businesses of all sizes. Try ZipRecruiter for free at our web address, ZipRecruiter.com/Bulwark. That's ZipRecruiter.com/Bulwark, BULWARK, ZipRecruiter.com/Bulwark. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. All right, we're back with Benjamin Wittes, the editor-in-chief of Lawfare blog. So here's my potentially awkward question about the Mueller report. I am a huge fan of the podcast that you folks have put together on the report, which continues to roll out. It is absolutely riveting. But I find it to be very, very frustrating and very depressing, because your report does something that the Mueller report does not really, or did not happen, which is it makes it clear how overwhelming and how troubling the evidence against this president is. And I guess the frustration part is the contrast between listening to this, knowing all of the stuff that's on the public record, and contrasting it with this failure to follow up on it over a period of many months. I'm guessing that you share that. But I'll tell you the more awkward question. As I listen to this, the overwhelming evidence, the details that are in that report that are on the public record, I'm also struck by all the doors that were not opened, all the leads that were not pursued, and the fact that in the end, Mueller, I think, it feels like he might have pulled his punches or did not understand the asymmetry of dealing with somebody like a Donald Trump, that he thought that simply writing this report without making recommendations, he thought that giving that appearance in front of Congress would in fact alert the public, but it didn't. And so as I'm listening to this report, I'm simultaneously incredibly impressed with the details in the report and disappointed that Bob Mueller just didn't go further.
So
the awkwardness is I don't want to criticize him, but I that disappointment is there.
No, Bob Mueller is not a god. He is a public official who produced a piece of work product, and the piece of work product is reasonably subject to a variety of criticisms, both from a lot of different angles. And I do think one of the legitimate areas of criticism is that it is pregnant with a great deal more than he articulates. And there are a few reasons for that. So one is that he framed his role as that of a prosecutor. He's not a historian. He's not an inspector general, right, who's just kind of examining conduct and telling the story and sort of figuring out if there's any problems. He's not a journalist, and he's actually writing what is effectively a set of prosecution memos for the attorney general. Now, in that context, I think he does a very admirable job with it. But here's the thing, and here's why I think your criticism has some merit. It is his decision to construct the investigation that way. And when that investigation was constituted, he was handed an existing set of FBI criminal and counterintelligence investigations. And a counterintelligence investigation is much more like what you're describing, which is you look around and you say, what's going on here? What is the foreign actor doing? What's Russia doing? And who are the people who are interacting with it? And what vulnerabilities does that create? That's a classic set of counterintelligence questions. Mueller did not take them on. He took on kind of only the criminal questions. And the result is that the answer to those what's going on here questions, the report is pregnant with, but he never tries to answer it. And I do think he deserves some, I don't know if it's criticism, I do think that's a judgment that he made that other people reasonably will disagree with and say, wait a minute, part of your function here was to take over that broad counterintelligence set of questions and to give answers to them, even if, by the way, answers that are so classified that you couldn't report on them in public. I do think he has to answer for not having taken those questions on.
No, I agree. Okay, so here's how I'm going to link this to the John Bolton firing. And it was an off-the-air conversation, which could have been a lot longer, a conversation yesterday afternoon with Chuck Rosenberg. And we talked about this very briefly, and he was talking about the code by which a Bob Mueller would comport himself, and how that you know, this is, you need to understand, you know, that whole code. It's the same sort of code that would lead a James Mattis not to be publicly critical of the commander in chief. And then this sort of morphed into this question of, well, this is the problem of the asymmetry of dealing with somebody like Donald Trump, somebody who destroys all the norms, and they're up against people who are by the book, people who still adhere to all of those norms and those codes of honor, but they're dealing with a man who is fundamentally dishonorable, which then sort of morphed into a conversation about, should John Bolton speak out? What is the right thing to do? Should you be more like Mattis, you know, who is being very, very reticent, at least for now? Or should he, if he believes that the president is making impulsive decisions that might put the national security at risk, does he have an obligation? And so we began talking about this, and I don't want to characterize Chuck's position, but he basically saying, you know, he has very mixed feelings about this. The presidents ought to have the right to be advised by, you know, professionals who are not going to then run out and try to cash in on all of this and go to cable news and, you know, write books and things like that. On the other hand, it did seem like we're dealing with that same asymmetry when you're dealing with a Mattis. Or maybe Bolton, who I want to put in a different, totally different category because he's not James Mattis, that when you're dealing with the arsonist in chief, you know, what is the obligation? You know, do we need more by the book kind of folks, or do people need to say, okay, you know, in an era in which the norms are being shattered, I can't be a prisoner of the norms. Do you follow where I'm going here?
Yep.
Okay.
So I think this is a really hard question, and I am basically of the view that if you want the honest serve, that the relationship between a president and these kind of old school people is a bilateral relationship. It's not, you know, that there's a mutual covenant there that presidents behave in a certain way. And as a result, people like James Mattis don't criticize the president, the sitting commander in chief, right? That people like Jim Comey don't, call up their friends and say, hey, I memorialized a conversation with the president. Feel free to share the contents of that with Mike Schmidt of the New York Times, right? And I do think that when the president shreds all of the norms, that will cause a reciprocal breaking of norms, and that is an inevitability. And so I do not fault those who, within the parameters of the law and the rules, you know, take matters into their own hands. And that said, the wrinkle here is that John Bolton is not one of these old school people, right? John Bolton is a kind of longtime bureaucratic power player who plays for keeps long before Donald Trump. And so here, Trump is picking a fight with somebody who thinks nothing of texting Fox News hosts while they're on air, texting Peter Baker, and like, all right, you're going to lie about me. I'll just text everybody I know and tell them, you know, what the real circumstances were. And so Trump is playing with somebody who, you know, plays Trumpy games pretty well. And you know, that I do think is a very different animal from, you know, thinking when you're thinking about the Bob Muellers and Jim Mattises and Jim Comeys of the world, who are varying degrees of old school. And the question is, how old school, right? Are you so old school that you'll be like Jim Mattis, or are you not so old school that in a truly exigent circumstance, you're going to do what Comey did that the inspector general just criticized him for? That's one group of people. Bolton is in a totally different category. He's in the category of people who would have always played like this.
You know, yeah, let's segue on a little bit because this gets me thinking about some of the other things that have happened over the last couple of days. And I was involved in a discussion of the president basically ordering the Weather Service to change its hurricane forecast. That, I mean, the president of the United States, you know, ordering or telling the bureaucracy to fix its message, which in many ways is kind of an eye rolling. Oh my God, you know, this is a president who is divorced from reality. But it did strike me that we seem to be in this phase now where the president is sort of now, just now, grasping all of the levers of power that he controls. And one of the things that I think saved us early on was the incompetence and the ignorance of the president, that he didn't know what he had, he didn't know what he could do. And now he's becoming more aware of that. And he's surrounded himself with people like the attorney general and others who will bend to his will. He, you know, that he can perhaps, you know, use the military in certain ways, you know, to enrich himself. You know, that he can get the Department of Justice. He can weaponize the Department of Justice to go after people that he doesn't like. That he can tell the bureaucracy to cover up his mistakes. And that really does kind of raise the specter of what a Donald Trump untrammeled by adults, but also, you know, with a second term, what he might be capable of doing here, you know. And there have been a couple of moments where, you know, the Department of Justice clearly under Bill Barr launching antitrust investigations of car companies, going after the president's political critics. I mean, this is really the kind of thing that was, I think, a theoretical danger early in the term, but it now is feeling like it's more aggressive.
I agree with that. And I think there's a few in the civil context. You mentioned the antitrust investigation of the car companies, but, you know, the ultimate coercive power of the federal government is the criminal context, right? Where, you know, they can lock you up. And, you know, the chant, lock her up, is a crude articulation of an actual government power, right? And the president has, since the campaign, really made occasional noises about using the coercive powers of the federal government to go after his critics. And he's been limited in that by a couple of things. One is having staff and Justice Department officials who are actually willing to do it. And the other is the ability to make a case against somebody, right? So, you know, if I say lock him up, referring to Charlie Sykes, I still need to be able to file an indictment against you that is colorable, right? And so it is only now that you're actually seeing situations where the president's enemies, there is a plausible enough criminal case against some of them that you actually are in the land where you can abuse this power. And the leading edge of that is, you know, the former FBI deputy director, Andrew McCabe, whom the president very deeply hates. And, you know, this is the guy who he asked him what it feels like to be married to a loser, right? And the president hates him, hates his wife. And McCabe was fired from the FBI having made some false statements about a leak that he was involved with, or a disclosure of information that he was involved with. And now there are reports that the Justice Department is getting ready to indict him for those false statements, which would be an extraordinary thing. These sorts of false statements in internal disciplinary and investigative matters are simply never prosecuted. And, you know, I have no doubt that if Andy McCabe is prosecuted, the reason for that will be found in dozens of presidential tweets about how much he hates Andy McCabe and thinks he's guilty of treason and thinks he should be prosecuted. And so without defending anything that McCabe may have done, which actually the IG report about him is quite upsetting, without defending anything he may have done, I do think it's a example of exactly what you're talking about, which is, you know, the president choosing his enemies for prosecution, not choosing the cases that actually most merit prosecution.
You know, this is that inherent incredible power of the presidency, that if you accept the idea of the unified executive, that the president can decide who is investigated, who, you know, and who is not. This is also the id of, you know, the Trumpian movement, which is to lock up people you don't like, to go after the people in the deep state, to turn around the whole Russia investigation into saying that, you know, we weren't the bad guys, the investigators were the bad guys, and this will be seen as proof of all of that.
Even though the matter that he's supposed to have lied about had nothing to do with any of this.
It certainly sends a chilling message, and that's the thing, is that it's a chilling message, and I think sometimes people lack imagination when you think about granting any individual or agency power to imagine, okay, how would that power be used or misused by an unprincipled actor or somebody with autocratic tendencies. And the fact is, we have gone way down the road of granting massive powers that really, really haven't tested how far is the system willing to bend on some of this stuff? I mean, we sort of remember we had that moment where we started realizing, well, the president can essentially promise pardons or pardon almost anybody without any check, with the exception of impeachment. And what might that mean? What does that mean for the rule of law? What does that mean for, fear, dealing with fear and favor with the president? So we're not through this in terms of, like, it can't get any worse. It can get a hell of a lot worse, can it?
It can get a lot worse, and particularly it can get a lot worse, I think, if the president gets anxious about his reelection prospects. You know, what he might do lashing out in anxiety as the election approaches is a very troubling, scary thing. And of course, it can get much worse in the context of a second term. And so I think you have to be concerned about the next year, in part for the reason that you articulated before, which is that the brakes are off and a lot of the people who served as restraints are not there anymore. And a lot of the people who are there because the president believes they will not serve as restraints.
So going back to the whole John Bolton issue, one of the great ironies, of course, is that John Bolton's always been the saber-rattling hawk, but apparently was sort of a restraining influence on some of the president's impulses. And even as we're speaking, the president is, the precipitating event, or apparently the precipitating event, was his attempt to cut this deal with the Taliban, including inviting them for a televised summit at Camp David on the eve of 9/11. What a great idea that was. But now he's also in the process of, it seems like hourly, making preemptive concessions to the Iranians. So you have the policy with the North Koreans, with the Taliban, with the Russians, with the Iranians, which, even if you disagree with John Bolton's hawkish views, it is sort of unnerving to think the degree to which our relations with those countries are being governed by the president's instinct, impulses, id, and his strange fascination with both televised events and his fascination with appeasing autocrats.
Yeah, so I mean, look, John Bolton, my enthusiasm for John Bolton and his foreign policy views is, I assure you, under control. And I'm not here in praise of John Bolton. That said, I do think he and the president complemented each other in some interesting ways, in particular that they are both people with sort of outlying foreign policy views, right? Bolton in the department of kind of, Bush era neoconservatism on steroids. And Trump in the neo-isolationist, sort of nativist, anti-internationalist department. And so you put them in these two positions together, and what happens is that they actually restrain each other in peculiar ways. So Bolton wants to attack Iran, and Trump is, you know, kind of that Trump's anti-interventionist streak restrains that. But also the president wants to make spectacular deals that are kind of untheorized and not to mention unnegotiated with all of our traditional enemies, from North Korea to the Taliban to Iran. And Bolton kind of runs a rearguard action, preventing those things from happening and scuttling them. And by the way, the president wants to jettison NATO, and Bolton kind of, you know, engineers last year's NATO communique before the summit ever happened, because he doesn't want, he kind of pre-rigs it so that Trump doesn't come in there and blow things up, right? And so I think these are, you know, I was joking yesterday on the Rational Security podcast that Madison said ambition shall be made to counteract ambition. And this, you know, the famous Federalist 51 articulation of the separation of powers. And this is eccentricity and insanity shall be made to counteract eccentricity and insanity. But they actually did have like a little bit of a restraint on one another. And I do worry about what happens now if the president doesn't have John Bolton's eccentricity and insanity to counteract his own. And I think the thing that you're describing, which is he seems to all of a sudden want a big, beautiful meeting with Rouhani, and he's willing to give a lot away in order to get it. I do think that's, you know, one area of concern. I also think it's kind of, you know, I wouldn't be surprised to see another chummy summit with Kim Jong-un coming down the pike.
Yeah, and those things are the ones where there are real consequences to those particular decisions. And you know, I'm not saying that all of the adults in the room are gone, and I'm not sure that John Bolton was always the adult in the room. And by the way, you know, people were saying that he was leaking all the time. His And the fact that he speed dialed every reporter in America, you know, the day of his firing, obviously wasn't very much of a defense of all of that. But you are you do wonder whether we're reaching this phase in this presidency, whether that id is now unrestrained. And here's a president who has you know, supreme confidence in his own instincts, and yet his own instincts on the international stage have been I want to say horrific, but they haven't really reached the horrific stage. They're just, you know, immensely nerve-rattling at this point. Benjamin Wittes, again, thank you so much for all of your time and for coming back on the Bulwark Podcast. You are one of the podcast's earliest friends, and we appreciate it very much.
Such a pleasure, as always.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we'll do this all over again.